The following podcast contains explicit language.
Previously on Empire on Blood.
Everything was on the news, it was in the papers, all because of that one corner.
Most of these cases, they intentionally did wrong work in the Calvin case?
Yes, from what I can see so far.
They don't care. You have to realize that not everybody cares. People like, man, F that.
Most of these guys in jail, I mean, that's all they do is try to figure out how they're going to get out. So I knew it was all bullshit.
I'm in jail for the rest of the life, guess what? With no family. Talk about a hard bit.
Would you say you're, do people ever find you a little weird?
Different. I don't care about being politically correct, and I don't search for the correct answers. I'll blurt it out. I'll tell you what I think. It's better that way up front. It is. It's a very good way to be. I don't care about offending others.
Joe Barry and I are sitting in a booth at my bar in Brooklyn. Did I mention that I own a bar? It's named Irv's, after my father, rest his soul. We just expanded, and hey, I'm proud of it.
Bigger glasses is what you need.
this will do the trick.
Needs me a little cooler. Need to get rid of the flies, not good. You're average.
You're not that.
You're average.
All right. What are you up to? Can't believe you think my bar is average. Jesus. Jesus Christ.
I'm ready to have another glass of wine, if you don't mind.
Not at all. But I want to know.
I serve these things on bigger glasses, man.
Joe. So this critic of booze portions is also a private investigator. He's Calvin Buari's private investigator. Years ago, I signed on as a journalist to get to the bottom of Cal's case. And I talk to people, even track down some new witnesses. But more than 20 years have gone by since the Harris brothers were murdered. I'm stalled. And frankly, my enthusiasm for this project isn't what it once was. Cal's case is not good for my career. Editors don't want the story. I'm trying to wean myself off the case, frankly. That's when Joe enters with his different approach.
My ways are unorthodox. My methods are unorthodox. I step on the gray line, which you're supposed to be on one side of the gray line. And if you're on the other side of the gray line, you're evil or bad. I'm on the gray line.
The gray line? What does he mean? Well, Joe once tracked a witness down on a golf course during the guy's Sunday foursome. Another time, Joe climbed a fire escape when a witness wouldn't answer the door. He likes ruses, as he says. Likes to pose as a flower delivery guy. Anything to get in the door.
Whatever it takes to get the information I need. You lie, Joe? Yeah, I do. I'm honest about it. If I'm not a liar, I can't work. But I'm not a liar because I'm a fraud. There's a difference. I'm a liar because I want to do good. Yeah.
This is Empire on Blood, a story of murder, betrayal, and a man who fought the law for two decades, and of one hard-drinking, honest liar of a private eye. I'm Steve Fishman. How did Cal find Joe Barry? It goes back to someone we met in the first episode, Emel McDowell. He was in prison with Cal, helped Cal with his legal case. As a rule, Cal distrusted just about everybody inside. But he befriended Emel. Emel and Cal, they had a crucial bond.
We were two inmates who were trying to plot ways to get our freedom, improve our innocence, and support each other. Neither one of us knew if we would ever get out of prison because we both had sentences that ended with life on the back.
Emel organized events in prison. I know that sounds weird, events in prison. But Emel's energetic. He was president of the local junior chamber of commerce, a chapter inside prison. And every month he hosted a get-together of inmates. They were linked by a common affection for the Chamber of Commerce and for the soda, pizza, and barbecue chicken wings that Emel served. They had a party tradition. Inmates would sneak leftover pizza and wings back to their cells in plastic bags they'd stuff down the pants of their green uniforms. Corrections officers didn't mind, except when they did. One day, an officer pops the plastic bag inside Cal's pants.
And that was one of the funniest things, because Cal thinks he's like a smooth, cool guy. So to have Mr. Smooth basically running back into the cell block with hot wing sauce all over his, you know, private parts. And the chicken, I don't know if the chicken fell out, because I asked him to. I'm like, Cal, so let me ask you this. Did the chicken wings fall out? And if they was in your drawers, what you did with them? Did you eat them? And so, you know, he didn't get mad, though. He would laugh. And he's like, come on, bro. How you gonna say that? But he's like almost in tears, because he's like, dude, like, that's some bullshit.
Emel was one of the few people who could actually tease Cal. And then, just before Christmas in 2009, Emel is sprung. He wrote his own appeal. Emel's murder conviction is vacated, and he makes a deal to go home after 19 years behind bars. On the strength of the appeal he wrote, Emel lands a job at a criminal defense firm. His boss buys him a suit, his first ever. He's busy on cases. He occasionally crosses paths with the assistant district attorney who prosecuted him. Imagine that meeting. But Emel, he doesn't forget his prison brother, the one he left behind.
He didn't expect it. I took a day off work and I drove to Greenhaven. And, you know, they called him down and he was excited, because last time he seen me, we were both wearing state green. Most of that visit, it was about 2 hours, he was smiling. And I'm just like, why are you smiling so much? And he's just like, yo, bro, I'm just so happy to see you. Like, you came back when you didn't have to, you know? And he said, but you made it. He's like, you out there. And he was like, if you got out there, I know my time gonna come. I know it's gonna come. And I'm like, yo, it's gonna come.
It's gonna come. If Cal can keep people like Emel thinking about him, helping him. But for the moment, it doesn't seem likely that Cal's time will come anytime soon. I visit him 5 years after Emel's visit, and Cal's case, it seems, well, it seems hopeless.
I just recently had a dream about me and my mother. You know, being home to be there with my mother, you know. And I know that this is a very depressing thing for my mother. And it was funny in the dream that Jonathan Fleming was also present. And I haven't had a dream where I was outside of prison in a long time.
Now, Fleming's a guy you knew in prison who's been exonerated.
Absolutely. And he's been exonerated after 24 years. And it was so good to see the joy and my mother's face, and, you know, to also have Jonathan Fleming there in support of me, who was also wrongly convicted. And that was a beautiful dream.
In the dream?
I was with my mother. And
sir.
Yeah, I was with my mother in her house, and she was just so happy to just have her son home.
That dream ended like all Cal's dreams. He woke up in the cell. Free in his dreams, caged when awake. But Cal, he endures. He doubles down on discipline, lives like a monk. He can't control events, but he can control himself. He follows a rigid schedule: Bible reading, tea, gym, shower, law work, letter writing, phone calling. As for meals, he cooks for himself in the cell.
Yeah, every day. Mm-hmm. Within the cell. I eat alone in the cell.
You're alone in your cell.
Yeah, I'm alone in my cell.
Cal controls his mind, too. He puts himself on a strict diet of positive thinking. Only books that help him stay strong. Psalms in the morning, that kind of thing. But at the top of his reading list is a surprising name, at least to me. James Allen, British, born in 1864, 1 year after the Emancipation Proclamation took effect, he is the author of As a Man Thinketh, published in 1903. From across a century, James Allen has a message for Cal. He can create his own reality. A man is literally what he thinks, Allen writes. Cal embraces this lesson.
So I have it right on my bed at all times. And I always read it. Like whenever I just start feeling a little frustrated or stressed a little, whatever, I always pick it up and I read it. You should check it out, Steve. This is probably no more than 40 pages, but it's powerful. That book changed my life totally.
I do check it out. It's not for me. The prose is baroque, pompous. Allen seems like a scold to me. But I take the point. That 19th century pamphleteer helps me understand Cal. The controlled, opaque persona, which I sometimes find frustrating, that's because Cal bans negative thoughts, negative words. For Cal, positive thoughts lead to positive results, just as James Allen says. And so Cal runs his campaign for freedom with optimism, even if that campaign seems increasingly hopeless to me. Cal won't register the setbacks, not for long. I know Cal sees me as part of his campaign, hardly the only part, though. Cal has a small platoon of helpers, women mostly. They post flyers near the scene of the crime, asking for information. They attend rallies. Tracy Coit is one of Cal's supporters. In 2012, she attended a rally for the wrongfully convicted in Brooklyn. She was wearing a T-shirt with Cal's photo on it. This is from a video posted on YouTube.
The DA is not even looking at evidence. Free Calvin Broadway. Free Calvin Broadway. Free Calvin.
So Tracy is one soldier for Cal's cause. Meanwhile, Cal keeps calling me with assignments.
I told you, Steve, I said, you know, I don't glorify and glamorify that stuff, and I'm actually a little appalled that, you know, at this stage of my life, that I did some of the things that I did.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
All right, Cal, it sounds like they're going to cut us off here.
Were you able to get in touch with Jonathan?
That's Jonathan Fleming, the exoneree who was in Cal's dream. Cal thinks that Jonathan, being exonerated, might have special standing to plead his case. I think Cal knows that that's a straw he's yanking at. But Cal, at this point, will try everything. And so, as James Allen advises, patience, practice, and ceaseless importunity.
I have reached out to Jonathan twice now and haven't heard back. I texted him, like you said, and I also called him.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
All right. Hey.
Sometimes it seems like only the old, dead James Allen is tuned to Cal's frequency. He writes, "Dreams are the seedlings of realities." And Joe Barry, well, he is Cal's latest dream. Hard-bitten Joe knocking back Pinot Grigio at my bar. I got him a bigger glass.
Are you carrying your equalizer?
I equalize. Listen
to him. Old beloved.
Let's go pick the shirt up. Let's see. Yeah, that looks like the real thing.
It is the real thing. It's big.
What kind is it?
Beretta.
After the break, Joe Barry and I go on a mission with a bottle of wine. We're back with Empire on Blood.
Joe, how much do you weigh? 126. And how tall are you?
5'11".
Slim Joe Barry had helped investigate Emel McDowell's case, and that work helped get Emel's conviction overturned. So Emel recommended Joe. But Joe is hard to get. Not busy, just selective.
Cal wrote me for 6 months. I kept blowing him off.
But because he was importune, if that's the right word, or importunate, if that's the right word, he just didn't leave me alone. So I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I looked at it. I took a chance. Was I convinced up front? No. But I made it clear. I don't want your money, and you don't need me if you did this. He decided to pay me and have people bring me money. Strangers. I didn't even know who they were. Met me in bars in Atlantic Avenue. All kinds of females. That guy had a lot of women stashed around New York City.
Joe is 62. He dyes his hair, or his wife Grace does. It's golden brown today. He favors sunglasses, carries a flip phone, and there's his physique. A man Joe's height should weigh 165 pounds, at least.
Yeah, you're about the right weight. You'd like to gain a little, or?
I lost a little on purpose.
Because it's bikini season coming up?
No, not at all. I used to weigh 150. I got rid of the 25 pounds or whatever it was. I changed my diet around. A man has to be accountable for what he puts in his mouth. You can't put everything in your mouth and think there's no accountability. When you're older, you're gonna pay. You know, you can't be eating chocolate bars and candies and cotton candies and jelly apples and fried chicken and fried steak and tender tourloins or whatever it's called and think there's no account. You're gonna pay a price later on. I'm under no medication. And I told Grace, throw the aspirin out the window. Give me a Jack Daniels. With a little honey, a little lemon, that'll do everything.
I'm going to make an observation here. James Bond, Jack Bauer, Jason Bourne, Joe Barry. Just saying. Joe didn't set out in life to be a private investigator. He set out to be a man of God.
I literally believe the Bible is the word of God. Whereas other people just think it's a nice book. Other people believe Jesus Christ is an
evolution. No?
Yeah, mankind's pushed that theory like they did the Big Bang, too. Bunch of pussies pushing that. I mean, come on, the Big Bang theory, we all came from monkeys. Any man with even half a brain looks at the sun, looks himself in the mirror, looks at the stars at night, can't give credit to the Lord God that made all of this stuff?
So, Joe wanted to attend seminary, but it turned out the seminary didn't want Joe. A dispute over the Holy Trinity, apparently.
You had some bumps in the road. Didn't you get fired from a number of jobs?
I got fired from God knows how many jobs, 12 at 14. Saw an ad in the newspaper for an undercover operative. I don't know what put that in my mind to go for that job. I went for an interview. I sat down. I had a bandana on my head, a bandana around my neck. I was dressed clean, no suit and tie. That's a lot of nonsense. And the guy at the interview says, you want a job? I says, yeah. And that was the start of my career in investigations.
Joe tailed a lot of cheating spouses. Not for him, that work. Then he hooked up with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Joe got an innocent man out of prison. With that case, Joe told me he found his calling. Dedicated to the truth. That's what his letterhead says.
Guilty and liars go away from me. Truthful people are attracted. They have something to say. Liars and guilty are afraid. They got something to hide.
Joe decides to take Cal's case. He hunts down witnesses, tries to. But a 20-year-old case, even for the righteous, that's a tough assignment. Then in 2014, the phone rings in Joe's office. On the other end, a dame. I can't help myself. Joe, well, he's like some private dick out of a film noir. The person on the phone identifies herself as Kimberly Clark. She says she was right there that night in the Bronx in 1992, on the day the Harris brothers were murdered. She saw it all.
I said, stop right there. I need to meet you. I don't want to talk about this on the phone. I don't know who's listening. I don't know who's listening to me talk.
Joe calls me. He knows I've been researching Cal's case. He knows I know email. Joe also knows that Cal's only hope is to discover new evidence. There's no DNA to go on, not even a murder weapon. But now, this new phone call may be an eyewitness from 20 years ago. Kimberlia had been approached by the police on the night of the murder back in 1992, but she'd refused to say what she knew, and then she'd disappeared.
A great lead in this investigation, and I could have been wrong, but I've done it so many times. And there are times I rejected the opportunity, and I kept it in prayer, and I used to say, Lord, please help me make a decision. And if the decision was to go, I have nothing to lose. I did the honorable thing. I spent the client's money wisely. I get to meet them. And if it all craps out, it's no worse for Cal.
So Joe spends Cal's money on an Amtrak ticket. It's a 12-hour train ride from New York City to North Carolina, where Kimberlia lives now. He invites me along. On the train, I reread the transcripts of Calvin Buari's original trial. When I'd first dug into the document, I'd been surprised. Wow, this is how justice works? There were deals and secrets. The system did seem stacked against Cal. But on the train, I think, all those witnesses, six of them, their testimonies perfectly aligned? They all agreed. Cal was a ruthless killer. And so, if Cal is innocent, then they all lied. And I wonder, could a lie really be so well orchestrated? Joe stares at the seat in front of him. He's been doing that all the way through New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. Suddenly, I have a sinking feeling. Have I really put myself under the wing of this weird gumshoe who suspects his phone is tapped and isn't convinced the earth is round? Is Cal wasting his money on a tough-talking nut job? Joe stares into the middle distance. Joe, I say, are you sure Cal's innocent? Joe turns to me. I'm sure. And then he goes back to staring. Joe's weird, but weirdly, his certainty reassures me. Joe's committed to innocence cases, and he's delivered before. But that thousand-yard stare, it unnerves me. Joe, do you want to read or something? To which Joe replies, and I'll never forget this. Some people like to read on a train. Some people like to sleep. I like to drink. And with that, he opens his overnight bag and pulls out a tube sock, inside of which is a bottle of wine. I must look alarmed. Don't worry, he says. I don't get stupid. And then he fetches a paper cup from the concession stand and gets to work. In Calvin Buari's case, there's one thing I've always suspected. There were others at the scene of the crime that late summer night in 1992. That neighborhood was always crowded with people. Where have they been? The next morning, we're at a Holiday Inn in High Point, North Carolina. And there she is, Kimberlia Clark, the witness who called Joe. I'd seen that name in police reports from 25 years ago, but they spelled it wrong. They'd written Kimberly. It's Kimberlia. That's why Joe couldn't find her. Kimberlia is in her late 40s. She's a big woman, well-dressed. We take a table off to the side of the lobby.
Hey, I'm just going to put this on here so I don't have to take too many notes.
Okay, go ahead.
That's very tiny.
Yeah.
Today is April 7th, 2015. But our mission is to go back in time, to the Bronx, where Kimberlia lived for 2 years in the early 90s. She lived on the second floor of 900 East 213th Street, right in front of the crime scene and the drug scene.
The streets is theirs. You understand what I'm saying? So whoever's outside, you got people from driving from wherever, coming from wherever, doing whatever. I don't want to see this, you know, but what can you say? You live in a box and people sell drugs.
Kimberly knows some of the dealers by sight. She knows Cal, Dwight, Peter. For the most part, they are respectful. Her view of the dealers is illuminating, but Joe, he wants to understand something else. Why would she want to talk now? She says it all started when she returned to the Bronx for a family reunion in the summer of 2014.
And I happened to be taking pictures, and I should have brung it. I should have brung them pictures.
You still can at one time in the
okay.
future.
And I was taking pictures, and when I looked at the picture, I noticed the picture behind me, because I was standing taking pictures over by my old place, by the Super Bowl, and I was just standing pointing at the stop sign of my old street. And I happened to look at the picture, because I didn't notice it at first when I was taking the picture, but I happened to look at the picture, and I was like,
is there another word you can use other than picture?
Photo?
Photo or a flyer?
But no, but I was looking at my picture. That's when I opened up, you know, you got the camera where you can zoom into the picture.
So to be clear, this is an insane fluke. Kimberly didn't know Calvin Buari had been convicted of a double homicide that happened in front of her building. Then one day, 22 years after the murders, she is taking photos in front of her old building. She looks at those digital images, notices a flyer in the background, zooms in, and reads what it says, Free Calvin Buari. And it was that image that led her to Joe. Joe's phone number was on the flyer, she says. Joe wants her to write a statement, a brief statement.
Just so you know, my spelling is not good.
That's okay.
I never finished high school.
But you can write a sentence.
I can write a sentence.
And it doesn't matter if it's misspelled.
Okay.
No,
that's just want to let you know. I might look good. But my spelling sucks.
What matters is what you saw. That's what counts here. Cal was not present when I saw it.
Okay.
When I heard these shots. Cal was not present. C-A-L.
A-L-I-V.
Okay, you want to put Calvin? That's fine.
Kimberly tells us she heard gunshots and then peeked out her window. She didn't see the murders go down, she says, but she saw someone by the car, and it wasn't Cal. We just took a long train ride to hear only that, but we're not done yet.
I asked you probably a few days ago if there's anybody else that you could think of that might be able to talk to us that would have seen this?
Maybe my sister. I'm pretty sure my sister. Because she was outside.
She was outside on the stoop when the murders went down. After the break, eyewitness number two. We're back with Empire on Blood.
Hello? Are you free for lunch?
What?
My sister said you said food. I'll call you right back. All right.
Kimberly phones her sister, Nakia Clark. Nakia followed Kimberly to North Carolina from the Bronx. In our hotel restaurant, it's now lunchtime. Nakia joins us and switches places with her sister, who takes a break outside. Nakia is 6 or 7 years younger than Kimberly and probably a foot shorter. She's a bit jittery, not the vibe of someone who wants to discuss a murder that happened when she was a teenager. So we chat about other things.
Can I get some sweet tea?
Sweet tea?
Sure. With extra lemon.
I think that's actually right.
You know, I guess I'll go the tea route, unsweet.
Unsweet.
Okay. Iced tea, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been sober now 16 months.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's fantastic, right?
My fiancé now is like the best thing in the world. We don't argue and fight, and he doesn't put his hands on me. It was a bad relationship.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see your ring.
Yes, it's beautiful, isn't it?
It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
He must really like you.
Yeah,
huh?
He loved me.
So how long did you live at 900?
with my sister, it was back, like, back and forth, because my mother lived in the Bronx, but she was on 149th and Southern Boulevard. So when I was, my mother smoked crack at the time. So there was a lot of times where I couldn't take it, so I would just go stay with my sister.
Mm-hmm. Rough growing up, huh?
It was really rough, really rough.
Kimberly's apartment was a refuge for Nakia, especially when she got pregnant at 16. The evening of the murders, she was 8 months pregnant.
All right, so since we're going there now, you're sitting in front of your house.
This I was
September
sitting
10th,
on the stoop here.
1992. When you say in front of the house, the
I was
outside
on the step? Yeah, there's a step. So I was sitting right there on the step.
Parked.
Yeah.
About how many feet from you?
Where that wall is.
So that's
probably a little further than that wall, but
20
about
20 feet or
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
And as you're sitting with this girl, tell me what you hear. Describe it in your own words. Shots fired, whatever.
Yeah, we were sitting there talking, laughing about something.
Right.
The car was sitting there.
Which car now?
There parking? Was a white car with two guys sitting in the front seat.
Did you know those two guys?
No.
So it was on 213?
It was on 213.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, because it was facing towards us, because the street goes this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did he come from the front of the car? Or did
he came from the back of the car.
You saw a gun in his hand, by the way?
Yeah. Because at first he was just regularly walking down the street.
Hands at his side?
Yeah. And then he just bow, 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 bow. I remember seeing them jerk. Because that's the worst part. Seeing them jerk and the flash, gun flashing. And then I jumped up and right. then I ran upstairs. And my sister was asking me what was going on, you know, what was happening. I told her what I saw. She told me not to say nothing. So I'm sitting in the house crying, losing my mind, because I couldn't believe what I just saw.
Did the police ever come?
They did.
Who opened the door?
My sister.
Your sister
told me not to answer the door.
Kimberly opened the door.
Yeah.
But she told you to stay away from it, but and she opened it.
She opened it and said not to.
What? So what did the cops
they
say?
They was asking.
Did Kimberly know you saw this?
Yeah, I told her. She knew
right
I
away?
Was outside.
Right away?
Once I ran upstairs, because she screamed. And I ran upstairs, and I told her. And she said, we're not talking about this. You're not telling nobody. Because we knew how it was over there. And I guess her being the oldest, and I'm glad she did, because he probably would have came after us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... And she said, they asked her, did she know anything about it? And she said, no. I didn't know nothing. We just heard something, and then that was it. They never came back after that.
It was upsetting.
Yeah, it really was.
Let me ask you, what are the chances of you being wrong? 10% wrong? 5% wrong?
No chance. Because that was horrible. Now they, what they call it, PTSD?
Yeah.
That felt like being in a war somewhere, and them flashes. And then when my sister told me, it was like I had to relive it all over again.
Are you a strong enough person to take a small beating on the witness stand if they say they
yeah,
call
I didn't
you a liar?
I've been called worse. I'm being called worse right now. So yeah, I can do that.
And if Nakia isn't strong enough, well, Evelina is. I find out that Nakia has an alter ego, Evelina. It's what her mom called her when her temper showed. Evelina is not to be messed with. Later, we drive to a nearby bank to get her eyewitness account notarized. But the bank official doesn't want to do it. She's not a customer, he says. Evelina gives him a look. I swear her eyes bulge. Her lips tighten to razor thinness. The bank official decides to make an exception. He notarizes her document. This is an amazing break after 20 years. It's stunning for me. And for Cal, it could be life-altering. Nakia, Evelina, is the kind of witness you want on your side. Fearless, maybe a little frightening. She saw the whole thing at ground level. She even says she knows who did it. But for the moment, she's thinking about Cal.
Now, finding out that just messes me up. Because, like, if I would have said something to the police, I mean, I feel like he wouldn't have to spend all his time.
You shouldn't have said nothing. But I don't think you did anything wrong.
What we have is chocolate cake.
You have whipped cream?
Yes.
I want a lot of it. Is it okay if I smoke a cigarette?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Steve, how are you?
I'm all right, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing better. I'm doing better.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm doing a whole lot better.
This is Cal almost 1 year after the sisters signed their affidavits. A lot has happened in the past year, not all of it good. On the strength of the new affidavits, Cal had found an advocate, the 85-year-old crusading attorney, Myron Belduck, the one who said to Cal, "I believe you." Belduck got a new appeal started. Everything was going great, and then Belduck died. I'd told Cal the news over the phone. Cal believed his life was in his attorney's hands. Now, Belduck was gone. On the phone, Cal fell silent. I fell silent. What was there to say? And then, Cal hung up. Radio silence. It was one of the many times I wished I could phone him. But Cal's in prison. I had to wait for him to call me. 2 weeks later, he finally did. Cal was changed, upbeat, making plans. The old Cal.
Hey, let me ask you, how did you get your determination back? How did you overcome?
You know what I started looking at? I got a collage of Myron pictures and the articles printed on him. And, you know, one of the things that just, like, his spirit touched me.
So Cal has a new assignment for me. Help him find a new lawyer. He asks me to conference in email.
All right, is everybody there? Calvin, it's email.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hey, email.
Hey, what's going on?
How you doing,
hey,
man? How you been?
I'm good.
All right.
How are you?
If anybody knows what I'm going through right now, it's you.
Email, now a suit-wearing paralegal, knows lots of lawyers. He thinks of the attorney who represented him in his final hearing, Oscar Michelin.
Definitely. I'll reach out to him. I would just start an email.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Touch with Steve, because I have Steve's number on my list, and I'll contact him, and I'll try to, you know, hear from Steve if you hear anything in regards to talking to the attorney.
All right. Yep. All right. Take it.
And Steve, take it. Yes.
Okay. Right. Sure.
So the plot thickens, and against my better instincts, I'm in deep again. Riding the train to debrief new witnesses, connecting the man on the inside to helpers on the outside. With Belduck's appeal based on the sisters' information, Cal's case could be reopened. The state had 6 eyewitnesses, but now Cal has his own. Still, a few things perplex me. Like Kimberlia. She really got Joe's phone number after zooming in on a flyer in the background of a photograph? And both sisters suddenly pop up after 2 decades? I think of someone who might help me evaluate these developments. Retired Bronx Assistant DA Alan Caron, Turtle Man. He hasn't heard about Cal's appeal or the 2 new eyewitnesses. So one day, I bring Calvin's new appeal to Turtle Man in his suburban area where turtles run free. We sit on his couch. I hand him the document, all 110 pages of it. He flips through it quickly, homes in on the sisters' affidavits.
What you do with something like this is you keep it in your bathroom in case you run out of toilet paper.
More manipulations from master manipulator Calvin Buari. That's how Turtle Man sees it. He knows how this works. Pass along a few talking points and an envelope of cash. That's how Calvin must have done it. And suddenly, I have a flicker of doubt. Turtle Man, he's been through this before.
Thought it would be great for you to come back and square off on this one more time. Huh?
If they want me back, I would reluctantly do that.
Reluctantly?
No, I would do it.
Next on Empire on Blood.
He's still alive, you know.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here, Steve. How you think I do?
Defense, you are obviously understand that the burden is on you.
What did you see when you looked at that window after the first few shots?
Cal's day in court finally arrives, again. Turtle Man waits for his phone to ring. Evelina's on pop. Cal wears cashmere, and everyone waits to see what Dwight will do.
It's time to go.
A kingdom built on blood leaves the king lonely. Bear the burdens of your sins and their homies. Beware the blurred line between friend and foe. The last words you hear.
It's time to go.
It's time to go.
It's
time to go.
Empire on Blood is produced by Emil Klein and Mia Lobel with Joelle Doucette. Our editor is Julia Barton. Original scoring by Joel St. Julian, theme song by Mr. Len. Fact-checking by Stephanie Daniel. Special thanks to Jason Gambrell, Evan Viola, Christopher Landry, Rachel Strom, Nicole Buntis, Christy Mirabal, Kate Miscal, Lisa Firestein, Jacob Smith, Carly Migliori, and Andy Bowers at Panoply. I'm Steve Fishman.